This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today.
Welcome to We Are Libertarians. We are very excited tonight to have a guest. But first, I want to say hi to our usual gallery of characters, which tonight is just Greg Lenz.
Joe, I'm doing well. How are you doing?
You know, ordinarily, Greg and I would be joined by one of the other cast of characters here at We Are Libertarians. But as we continue to miss our fearless leader, the king of all libertarians, Chris Spangle, we have reached out to a friend who may be able to class this place up a little bit.
Dear leader has been abducted by the great white menace of the North, and we haven't heard from him since.
Mm-hmm. Greg, let me give you a little bit of a personal testimony real quick before we start the show. And that is that when I first became politically disillusioned, I went through two phases. The first was this period of apathy. I sulked a bit, and I looked at the political landscape. I realized I didn't know a lot. I felt a lot, but I didn't know a lot. And what I was feeling was just kind of this sense of betrayal, having been foolishly giving my votes to people who didn't really seem to know anything about anything. And then the second phase came. The apathy went away, and I began to do a lot of reading. And you know me, by no stretch of the imagination am I an academic or an intellectual. I really prefer the basics in life. But in my time of need, I stumbled upon the Ludwig von Mises Institute. One of the first books that I bought from them was a 2-volume set, and it was the Bastiat collection. And have you ever had one of those teachers who took an extremely intimidating subject and they just made it really fun? It was well communicated. It was easy to understand.
I did. My home ec teacher. For me, that was always the most intimidating coursework I'd ever done.
Well, I didn't think that I would understand economics at all, and I was, in fact, really intimidated by it. But Bastiat was that kind of guy, like right off the bat for me, reading through this book. And that brings us to our guest for the night. We're really proud to have him here because he wrote the introduction to that collection and, from what I understand, really helped to spearhead that project. So thanks to him, and that was very influential for me. So he is the senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, serves as the book review editor of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. And if you think this introduction is long, get on Google and find this guy's resume. I mean, he's just really done a lot of great work, and I feel like we should have invited him on a long time ago. Ladies and gentlemen, for the first time on We Are Libertarians, Dr. Mark Thornton.
Hey, Joe. Hey, Greg. It's great to be on the show. It's great to meet you guys. I know you've been doing some great work, and the Bastiat collection was a labor of love for me, and the Institute was able to put it out in a 2-volume hardback collection. Beautifully done, and we were able to sell it for $44 because of the support from our members, and it's unfortunately sold out, but I'm happy to announce tonight for the first time that this spring we're going to be issuing a Bastiat reader, which is going to be a condensed version of the Bastiat collection, and it's only going to contain really the greatest hits. Mm-hmm. So it's like the greatest hits of the Beatles or the Rolling Stones. These are the essays that have made the biggest impression in terms of economics than probably any other author in the history of mankind. It's going to contain things like The Law, mm-hmm, and Petition to the Candlemakers, and just a lot of great fundamental, The Broken Window, essays. And so that's going to be out this spring, and it's going to be, you know, small and very inexpensive, and we're hoping to turn on an entire new set of fans of Frederick Bastiat and his work and the Austrian Economist and the Mises Institute as well, of course.
It's funny that you draw the comparison to the Rolling Stones and to the Beatles, because Bastiat was a bit of a rock star, at least in our circles.
Oh, absolutely. I was doing an interview and with a reporter, and he said that he had done a webcast about The Law and that it went viral for some reason about Bastiat and The Law. And Amazon, it was the top-selling book on Amazon, and they had completely sold Amazon out of the law, which essentially means that all the suppliers were also out of it because, of course, Amazon can draw in from all the major suppliers of that little pamphlet. And that's not the first time that's happened, actually, with the law being exposed, that little essay, being exposed to the general public, because in that essay, which is included in the Bastiat Reader, Bastiat lays out what is true human law, what is true human law across civilizations, across time and history. And then he contrasts that with man-made governmental law that politicians, think up and vote on. And basically, that second half of the law is a sort of a condemnation of neocons and they're striving to make government much more important than society.
Yeah. Now, I know, do you run into that quite a bit in academic circles? I know my father's actually, he's a former professor. He just retired last year at Indiana University. And do you run into your essentially line of thinking and political philosophy encountering quite a bit of resistance?
Well, I think that Bastiat lays outside of academia. He's very, very popular since he wrote in the 1850s with the common man. But inside academia, he's not widely liked. But with respect to the spirit of the contents of the law, I think there is some academic support for this distinction between law that is common to all men. You know, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not defraud one another. And, you know, just basic things that have to be law for society to exist. And then this discretionary law, which varies from country to country, which varies over time. You know, the government will have a monopoly on the postal service. There will be a central bank. There will be public schools. Those are all discretionary things that are not the law. You know, the speed limit is 55 miles an hour. Those are discretionary, bureaucratic, and politically determined rules, which politics tries to impose on human behavior. And so that basic distinction, I think, is acceptable or has to be acceptable to a wide variety of academics until you get to those that are neocons and fascists and socialists, where it's precisely their point of view that the government is the law.
Yeah.
And the government is the most important aspect of society, and that the people are just the machinery on which the state survives.
Yeah, the means of production, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. The means of production. It's just raw material for the glory of the state.
Yeah, and you've actually written quite a bit about that. If I'm correct, your dissertation actually was The Economics of Prohibition that ultimately became your book, correct?
That's absolutely correct. I did my dissertation at Auburn University. I was supported by the Mises Institute from the very early days of the Institute, and that eventually was published as a book from the University of Utah Press, and it's still in print today. It's never gone out of print. It still sells a lot of copies. And one trick that I want to tell your audience about tonight is that if you go to Mises.org and, you know, you're looking for my book or the Bastiat collection, you can just go into the search bar and type in the name of the book and add in at the end PDF. And if we published it and we have the rights, a PDF version of the book will pop up so you can get a very good look at what's in the book. Or if you're doing a paper or something and you need a quote or you're looking up a fact, well, you don't necessarily have to buy the whole book to get that material. And that's basically free. You can also get, of course, very inexpensive e-copies of our books. And the hardback and paperback copies are at subsidized prices. And so we encourage people to look at our stuff for free before they buy it.
Absolutely. And I think it's such a service because you'll hardly find someone that, even if they maybe aren't a committed Big L party member libertarian, that their introduction, much like Joe's, to libertarianism was through the writings of the Bastiat Institute. Or the Mises Institute. Sorry, I'm thinking about Bastiat so much.
Well, there is a Bastiat Institute now, too, which we're very happy to see. And there's now 20 Mises universities around the world, excuse me, Mises Institutes around the world that are not directly affiliated with us, but that have been built on our model. And they use our materials and very often translate our materials into other languages. So we've got a German one and a Japanese one and a very, very successful one in Canada, just to the north of you guys. And, you know, like I said, the Institute, it's still pretty small, and we survive on the contributions of our donors, but they made it possible for me to continue on in graduate school and complete that economics of prohibition. And getting back to your original question, I mean, that's a great example of discretionary political rules that are imposed by the political process, and of course, which have had disastrous effects in practice, whether you're talking about alcohol prohibition of the 1920s or, of course, the war on drugs today.
Yeah. I mean, and that kind of leads us into our, you know, first topic is when the state becomes that sort of iron-fisted leader as far as banning alcohol or drugs, anything of the sort. We were really interested because you had written in the past about jury nullification. And that's something that I think is by the – and I guess the elite ruling class wanted to keep, one, a secret. And then, two, most people just aren't familiar with what exactly it is and how exactly you go about it and then spread it. So that can be, I guess, a stop to the state and to laws that should not necessarily be on the books and that the people decide they don't want to enforce.
Yeah, I think jury nullification is a very important weapon in the survival of liberty. And I did write recently about the legalization referendum in Colorado in Washington and how jury nullification or nullification could play a role there. But basically, jury nullification is that when a court brings somebody to trial on something like, you know, possession of marijuana, and they have evidence that clearly indicates that the person actually did possess marijuana, a jury faced with those facts and those considerations can still vote against conviction based on the right of jury nullification. And this is a standing right in America, in the United States, where if a juror's conscience dictates that a person guilty of a crime, such as marijuana prohibition, they can still vote not to convict the person of that crime. And so this is a very important check on the ability of the political process to do what it wants. And basically, we encourage, you know, as libertarians, we encourage people to know about this right and to use it where they think it's proper. So if it's a murder conviction, you know, that's a different story. If somebody's guilty of violating people's property rights or hurting, harming them, jury nullification wouldn't have much of a role, although it still could. I mean, you could still be guilty of murder, but with extenuating circumstances, the jury may not convict or may convict at a lower level. But this is something that could be used against prohibition. Both nullification and jury nullification could prevent a lot of good people who've done nothing really wrong to stay out of prison.
Yeah, I know when I speak with people about it, and I'd be interested to see what you think, is – in a lot of cases, and it's not, you know, I wouldn't recommend jury nullification, obviously, in every case because there are just laws that are broken. But it really helps give context because I feel like the legal process in the United States is very exclusionary and it doesn't allow the full story to be told a lot of the times, especially when it comes down to the expertise or the skill of the attorney involved in representing the defendant. But if somehow, jury nullification, we are able to spread its message, it's going to fill in a lot of the details and a lot of that context. And I wondered if you felt similarly or how you what you thought about that.
Oh, I think it's a very, very underused right that we have. And I think it's been suppressed by the state. And attorneys are not allowed to bring this up during trial, so that jurors are very often oblivious to the fact that faced with the facts that somebody has committed a crime against the state, they can still vote not to convict them and not to penalize them. And so this is something that's been suppressed.
Absolutely.
Do you know of any specific instances where this right has been exercised and where it's proven effective?
I can't recall anything specifically, you know, in state actual cases, but there certainly have been cases where people have been arrested for possession, and the state, for example, there I know of a couple of cases where small-time marijuana growers who had a couple of plants in their backyard were arrested, and they were charged as growers and distributors, because instead of weighing the amount of flowers on the marijuana, which is what is actually smoked and sold, the police weighed the entire plant, including the root ball. And so they really had less than an ounce of pot, but the state weighed it in at over 6 pounds in one case, and I think over 10 pounds in another case that I read about. And so they were charged as growers and distributors, which could have brought, you know, 10 or 15 years of prison time. And I think in one case, they escalated the charges to include, you know, possession of a weapon and some other charge. So it was three strikes and you're out. So this person was going to go to jail for over 15 years. And luckily, there was, I think, just a single juror in both trials who was able to bring this up to his fellow jurors in both cases. And so they were not convicted of the crime of being a distributor or a dealer, a grower. And so that was successful. And I think there's been several of those. You know, and then there's also the distinction between jury nullification, which is on the smaller end, and then there's the case of nullification, which is where the local political process nullifies the laws of a larger political body. And the most recent example of that is Colorado and Washington nullifying federal marijuana laws.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny, those are both extremely interesting. I find I really find that the nullification at the state level, you know, originated with the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions by, you know, Jefferson and Madison going down those routes and making sure that that was available against the Alien and Sedition Acts. And then at the state level, I don't know. Have you ever read the book Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell?
I know of it, but I have not read it.
In it, he actually cites an example that in New York City, their crime was becoming just an enormous problem in the 70s, 70s and 80s, all the way up to the early 90s. And then it sort of – the trend went away. And one of the things he attributed to the decline in crime in New York City was – I believe it was a retired school teacher that was on the subway. And the people of New York City had been very sick of being mugged, being held at gunpoint, having their things taken. And this school teacher goes, he's on the subway on his way home. It's rather late at night. And five gang members come up to him and attempt to rob him. And he had been ready and waiting, and he actually shot him to death. And the jury found him not guilty, regardless of what the facts were that were presented. And it's something that isn't a highly publicized case, but it is something that at a certain point, the people, if they can't get justice, they're going to take it into their own hands. And I feel like in the United States, the way you get that out is maybe, you know, you make a movie about it. If you've ever seen the movie Time to Kill with Matthew McConaughey, just won Best Actor, you know, you in culture is where a lot of people get their stories and how they learn about the law. And I feel like there needs to be there's tons of academic work in libertarian circles, and philosophical work, but sometimes I feel like where we lose out is in from a cultural perspective.
I've got the first show for you, Greg. We're going to start a television show based on Mark's story about those who are in trouble for growing and distributing, and we're going to take back the name Growing Pains. That'll be your first TV show.
What do you think, Mark? You'd be interested in writing that show?
Sounds like a great plan, and you're absolutely right, Greg. We've got a pretty good academic fortress of ideas, and we're teaching those ideas to more and more students and people and citizens every day. We're really taking the message to the street. You know, Murray Rothbard in the 50s and 60s, there was only a handful of libertarians really in the entire United States. And Murray was often quoted as saying that half of the libertarian movement was meeting in his living room. But nowadays, see, we've got the advantage because we've got ideas with a small army of scholars behind them. But now we have these internet radio programs such as yours, which is like being in a living room with fellow libertarians, but it's not just 7 or 8 people. It's 700 or 800 people. It's 700 or 8,000 people. Mm-hmm. And this is going on all over the place. And so I've gotten, you know, when you look around the world, you think, oh my God, the world is going to hell. And, you know, we've got the Russian crisis and Ukrainian crisis and Obamacare. But I think ultimately underneath the surface, we're actually winning. And what we need is more of these living rooms, more of these cultural pathways of TV shows and movies, you know, and that kind of material that can really switch and sway the public opinion in general in a massive and very quick way. And so I think we're close to a tipping point, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
It would not surprise me if things happen a lot faster than a lot of other libertarians think.
Yeah, I mean, and it's the news, everything I feel like has accelerated. Like, for instance, now the majority of people I think polled would support gay marriage or at a bare minimum civil unions, which, you know, isn't necessarily a libertarian perspective. It's just it's an improvement over saying, you know, no, you can't even live in the same house. But Will and Grace in the 90s, in the early 2000s, I feel like that's sort of the example maybe that a portion of the libertarian movement needs to insert itself into. And like I've seen the Atlas Shrugged movies, and granted, you know, Ayn Rand's not necessarily a libertarian, but that to me was the first time I can remember a truly libertarian or a, I guess more Atlas Shrugged being more of a good example of capitalism. And that's just such a huge seismic shift in the major media.
Yes. And we're looking forward to many, many more of them. And we have no idea what's going to happen 6 months from now or 12 months from now. You know, gay, as you say, gay marriage isn't exactly a pinnacle libertarian issue, but even libertarians recognize that it shouldn't be the state that decides who and who cannot make such contracts there or any other place, basically. And so that's a seismic shift. And another seismic shift is that, you know, when Milton Friedman said that he opposed the war on drugs in 1972, barely 10% of Americans thought that marijuana should be legal. Mm-hmm. And since that time now, it's like 58% think recreational marijuana should be legalized, and 78% think that medical marijuana should be legalized. And so, you know, most of what Austrian economics does is really very technical, tedious economic analysis. And to prove that, you know, you can just go to Mises's Human Action or Murray Rothbard's A Man, Economy, and State and just pop open the book and hand it to one of your friends, and they're probably going to, their eyes are going to glaze over. Mm-hmm. But we do have a very specific view on political change, and that is that we view along with a lot of other great thinkers in history, that ultimately society exists based on the ideology of the population, not the ruling class, and that no state and no ruling class can survive and dictate to the majority of society anything that they don't believe in. And so I think a lot of American history, you know, we started out as a very libertarian society, and over time we became a very patriotic society, that anything America does is what's right. And so we're trying to change that ideology back to the original vision of the founding fathers. And when that happens, you just automatically see political change, and Colorado and Washington, the state of Washington's legalization movement, I think, is a great example of that. The fact that 20 states have legalized medical marijuana. My God, the state of Georgia in the House of Representatives just, I think, yesterday passed on the House side legalizing medical marijuana. And let me tell you, I mean, there's very few states that are as backwards as the legislature in the state of Georgia.
Well, wasn't there a Georgia congressman that challenged someone to a duel not too long ago?
Yeah, I mean,
Zell Miller.
Yeah, I mean, we've got there's a lot of great things about the South, and I'm originally from New York, Western New York State, and let me tell you, I mean, I love living in the South and living in Auburn, Alabama, where the Institute is located. It's a wonderful place, and they're wonderful people, but politically, they tend to be very backwards. And I just did a study recently. The Gallup poll came out, and it ranked the 50 states from the most successful and prosperous and happy states to the least successful, prosperous, and happy states. And of the top 20 states, the 20 best states, 13 of them had passed legalizing medical marijuana.
And, well, they had nothing to worry about, right?
And the 10 worst states, none of them had passed medical marijuana, and all 10 were in the South. Now, the odd thing here is that I've seen a poll dating back more than 5 years ago, and the vast majority of Alabamians support legalizing medical marijuana, but politically, the political apparatus has not been willing to budge much other than introducing such legislation, but never bringing it up for a vote. And so enlightenment comes very slow sometimes, and then all of a sudden it snowballs and things happen very quickly. And I hope that we're fairly close to that in Alabama and our surrounding southern states, you know, because we have, in many of these states, we have good economic frameworks, but we have very poor political and social frameworks. And that has only changed very slow, but as we've seen elsewhere, the change can come at a much faster radical pace, given time and circumstances.
Absolutely.
You know, talking about how quickly things can move, I wanted to take a step back when we were talking about, I guess, how we consume information. And I always imagine it as pulling a lever on a slot machine at a casino. You know, the little thing, the dial's turning, and then it finally lands on something. So that's how our news feeds are on Facebook, on Twitter. We are consuming the news nowadays. And what is the Mises Institute doing to kind of tackle that next generation, that short attention span, to make things, you know, you guys are putting out a lot of really important works, but how do you take those works and make them more interactive and user-friendly in a world that has such a brief attention span?
Well, we're actually very busy at it, and we've actually been going through some very radical changes over the last year, year and a half or so. We've become very active in social media, where we basically had inert social media. Now we have very active Twitter feed and a very popular Facebook page that we're growing very fast, and we're on Instagram, and so we're making moves. There's several LinkedIn groups that are associated with Austrian Economics where you can go there and see that material from the Institute is a dominant theme, and also on other Facebook pages besides our official Facebook page, there's probably a half a dozen or more Austrian economic sites. We're also totally rebuilding Mises.org to take it to a more modern professional level, mm-hmm. where it's going to be where you're not just going to have to go, you know, swimming your way through the world's largest economic webpage. We are literally the largest in terms of material. We're one of the most searched and used websites in the world. But now, and it's all, you know, basically free and there's no registration, but now you're going to be able to register. And so we're going to be able to customize your experience so that what you've done in the past is going to be reflected in what you see in the future. And so, and another thing we've done is we've started a new series called the Mises View. And these are video entries on our webpage. And of course, video is, you know, speaks directly to your point there. I mean, I do lots of audio interviews such as this, mm-hmm. and we have an incredible amount and flow of that sort of thing. But this Mises View is going to present our leading scholars, and we're going to be talking about the issue of that day, and we're going to do it hopefully in less than 3 minutes. And I can give you a sort of a heads up. I just did one before I came on air here on Obamacare. And Obamacare is something that I've never written anything about. I've never recorded it. I've never even done an interview about it. I did 100 interviews last year, and not one was about Obamacare. So this is a subject that I haven't touched. But I talked to somebody today about Obamacare, and so I did a Mises View. And basically, this friend of mine who's single and 50 years old, semi-self-employed, doesn't work very much, so doesn't have much income, and she was taking in a catastrophic health care plan. And so my friend, facing this over $1,000 a month health care, which is about how much she makes in a month, she went to the Obama exchanges and got a really good comprehensive health insurance policy for $1.75 a month. Now, that's great for her. But what that means is that $998.25 has to be subsidized by somebody else like you or me. And so Obamacare means massive subsidies from the young to the old, from the healthy to the sick, to the high income to the low income. And, you know, this is something that Mises paid a lot of attention to with respect to Nazi Germany.
Yep.
Nazi Germany, they went in with a plan to reinvent society, and they started trying to pay for it, and they had to print money. That caused prices to rise, and so then they had to put in price controls, and then they had to put in quotas, and so they ended up controlling every aspect of society and telling all the business people, you know, you have to produce this, you have to produce so much, you have to pay your workers this. And so it became what Mises called German socialism, or backdoor socialism. And that's what we're getting here under Obamacare.
Oh, I know. I forget the actual individual that said this, but I once heard that in America, socialism won't come through revolution. It'll come in a wheelchair, meaning that as the population ages and grays, it'll be the health care that actually ultimately makes America become a socialist state.
Yeah, and it's so big in our economy. You know, it's such a big sector of our economy. And the reason, one of the reasons it's gotten so big is because it's gotten so bloated and nobody pays market prices.
No.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say they don't at all. I mean, everybody would like a BMW if it was adjusted on income. And everything is, I mean, the worst part about it to me is that if people think that healthcare is expensive now, wait till it's free.
Yeah. And a good example of that is a friend of mine went to the hospital for a procedure. And this was not emergency or anything. His doctor sent him. And the doctor said, don't file your insurance on this. Just pay cash. And my friend was kind of upset, thinking, why not file for the insurance and have them pay for it? And the doctor said, well, if you pay cash, you'll pay less for the procedure than the copay. And so even though it was $300, it would be less than the copay, which was going to be more than $400, and the insurance company would have been billed almost $1,000. And so when you look at what the free market price is versus what the bloated government insurance, comprehensive insurance price is, it's a very, very small percentage. And it's just an example or a sample of what we're missing out on by turning our backs on the free market.
Absolutely. And to me, what it's really an example of, and that really kind of leads us into our next topic and what we wanted to pick your brain on, is it was an example of almost a dictatorship over a segment of the economy. Obviously the health insurance companies could have fought it. They could have decided to, no, in fact, we will not be dictated to by the government, but I think they made that decision a long time ago. And so something I wanted to talk with you about, since you're a professor of economics, is let's say that we made you the czar of the economy. Or that's funny. Alexander Hamilton was the first U.S. example of jury nullification. So let's say you were the first Treasury Secretary like Hamilton, but you were an economic dictator. What would your reforms be? Why? And how do you think it would improve the American economy?
Wow. We could do a couple shows on this one.
Right.
At the Federal Reserve, I would simply tell the Fed not to intervene in the federal funds market and to allow interest rates to float to their market levels. To the U.S. Treasury, I would say start minting gold and silver coins as dictated in the Constitution. And in healthcare, I would repeal Obamacare and basically just about everything else, including the monopolies that the pharmaceutical companies, the physicians, and the hospitals have. And I would create an unlimited tax credit for catastrophic health insurance so that you could buy catastrophic health insurance for you, your family, your friends, your housekeeper. And it would all come right off the top of your tax bill.
That sort of sounds like kind of like a mutual aid type of community, where it would be a tax credit that could be put upon one individual who had the means, but the aid would actually go to the individuals who were unable to.
Yeah, and I would create an unlimited Roth IRA type, flex medical account. So you could take off all the income you wanted to out of your check before taxation. Of course, I'd also like to repeal the 16th Amendment. But in terms of healthcare, if you could do that so that the rich people could take all the money out they wanted to and put it into health savings accounts for themselves and their families and their relatives and their friends and their housekeeper, and so that medical system would be back on a free market essential basis, and people would be, consumers would be paying free market prices. I think that would do a great deal to solve the healthcare situation that we have in this country.
Absolutely. I think if you look at procedures which don't benefit from insurance, like Botox, from LASIK, those types of things, they're driven down necessarily by competition in the market and supply. And this is actually something I've written quite a great deal about. I took a course that was like a graduate course in healthcare economics in college and kind of put together my own plan of why I thought it was why I thought my plan would actually lower the cost curve compared to the president, or really more Hillary care, why I thought that would drive it up. And it's that idea that if you make it so people are spending their own money, they're going to be price conscious. We have sort of a distortion in asymmetric information between the doctor and the patient. And one, we need to improve that. But two, with doctors, a lot of times they can create their own demand by prescribing a follow-up or by prescribing that you go see a specialist. And I'd like to think they don't abuse that, but I can't help but think they have to because of the way the insurance industry exists, and they have to make sure there's no hole in their prescription. Otherwise, they won't get reimbursed by the insurance company. Do you agree on that?
Yeah, absolutely. America spends way too much money and is very, very unhealthy. And there's a reason for that. And, you know, we for every man, woman, and child in the year 2012, we had 13 prescriptions written, more than one a month for everybody. All the healthy people, all the sick people. So we're taking way too much medicine, pharmaceuticals, and we're not healthy. We're overweight. We've got incredibly high rates of heart disease and diabetes. So the system is not really working. It's not making us healthy. It's just keeping us alive in a very unhealthy state. And, you know, the free market would put people in charge of their health care, and they would want to be buying things that fixed the problem rather than masked the problem. And we're just very, very far away from that under the current regime. So I think, you know, tax breaks for catastrophic health care and medical savings accounts would put us back in charge and would encourage consumers to look for effective and particularly cost-effective ways of addressing our concerns, and then just make us more concerned about staying healthy rather than spending money by the zillions of dollars in this healthcare system.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds like to you, as economic czar of the, if there's ever a libertarian administration, I will gladly nominate you if I have any ability whatsoever. But it sounds like you would tackle one, you would go back to a hard currency. Two, you would reform the healthcare aspect of the American economy. And then how about tax policy? I mean, you've mentioned several things about an unlimited tax credit for health savings or for catastrophic policies. But how about in any other, do you have, and I don't mean this negatively, but do you have your 999 plan in the pocket, if you will?
Well, there's lots of ways you could go about reforming the system, but the federal government needs to be incredibly smaller than it currently is. You know, and if you have a sound money and you structure the government so that it doesn't have a standing army and it has little military capacity. I mean, right now the U.S. spends more money on military spending than all of the other countries put together. And so I think we need to bring that way, way down and bring the troops home, disband the troops, and stop fighting, trying to control the rest of the world. Basically, you know, for your listeners, the U.S. has an undeclared empire. And, you know, we're controlling Japan in the east, Germany in Europe. We have bases and troops in 150 countries. And so it's very, very important to get the military situation under control and back to a normal, peaceful level. And so that would be a big issue. And I think that once you start putting the federal government on a proper level, that you can certainly do away with the income tax entirely. And I would also like to see the assets of the federal government sold off to a large extensive degree, because they possess a lot of resources that the private sector could use effectively and economically, and right now they're just being wasted, and the American taxpayer has to foot the bill for for maintaining all of this stuff. I mean, the federal government has 59,000 buildings that are not in use and supposedly had there some expense with maintaining and guarding those buildings. So the American federal government has run amok, and there are so many things that have to change from the ethanol subsidy to the income tax that we could go on all night about all the things that need to be repealed and sold off and privatized and just outright eliminated, like the spy state. I mean,
yeah,
we're spending untold tens of billions of dollars on 11 different spy agencies that have grown exponentially since 9/11 and even more in recent years.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Snowden issue, in all reality, since the CIA's budget, I believe, is black and unlimited, that isn't subject to any limit, more than likely was an increase to their appropriation.
Yeah, and it's not the only one. I mean, there's 11 different major spy organizations within the federal government, and they all are spending billions of dollars. And, you know, so even if you could make the case that the United States needed some kind of intelligence service about other countries, and, you know, I'm not an expert in that area, and there may be a case to be made that we all want to know what each other's secrets are in terms of different national governments, it seems to me way over the top that we have 11 different agencies and that we're spying on every phone call and email within the United States, as well as spying on all the politicians and bureaucrats of our friends as well as our enemies, and yet they don't seem to be able to do anything
correctly.
They
don't do anything about it. I don't know about you, but I personally love to read what Angela Merkel had for lunch each day. I think that's a dollar well spent.
Yeah. I mean, that's just 1984 taken to the absolute limit, and you know, I think the American public recognizes that. Even people who were patriotic neocons, you know, they have a hard time getting on board with that kind of stuff when they find out that their stuff is actually being spied on.
Yeah, I mean, it always hits. It's always someone else's problem till it's you.
That's right, and you know, so it's okay to spy on the Russians. And then, well, maybe we want to know what's going on with the, you know, with the Germans and, you know, our friends in Israel. Well, they have every right to know what we're up to.
Absolutely.
Then when it's in their what's in their own backyard and spying on their the customers of their own company, they take a different viewpoint. And I think everybody needs to take a different viewpoint and realize that this stuff is unnecessary. It's counterproductive, it's un-American, and it's very costly.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, so actually earlier – or as actually last week, Senator Joe Manchin had called for a ban on Bitcoin after Mt. Gox, one of the Bitcoin exchanges, was hacked and the Bitcoins were stolen. And then among his concerns, though, were not necessarily the people who were wronged, more so that Bitcoin is a way to undermine the government, subvert their ability to ban illegal substances, and really anything the government has not deemed okay for right now. And I mean, I understand that the state's always going to want to make sure that they are in control of the currency. But I was wondering what you thought about Bitcoin, Dr. Thornton. And then do you see it as a viable alternative to the gold standard? And then just lastly, if you could create your own virtual cryptocurrency, and feel free to ask me about these later on. I don't expect you to remember them all. What you would create a cryptocurrency and what it would look like and how it would function.
Well, I think Bitcoin is great. It's been a very entertaining story and a very profitable one. And, you know, and we've known that eventually this was going to come about, and we knew that the state was going to oppose it. And we knew that there were going to be all these problems of trying to set up and manage a cryptocurrency. But the idea that somehow the state has the right to ban this because Bitcoins are used in illegal transactions is really laughable, because it's actually the US dollar that is the currency du jour. in the international illegal drugs and illegal, you know, all of that, 99% of that is the U.S. dollar. You know, they're not really using the euro very much, and they're not using the Italian lira or whatever. They're using the U.S. dollar, and Bitcoin is less than 1%. In total Bitcoin transactions, there's less than 1% of all international illegal transactions, and less than half of Bitcoin transactions, a far smaller portion than half, are used in illegal transactions. So the idea that Bitcoin is somehow expanding illegal transactions is ludicrous. It's the U.S. dollar that is supporting the slave trade, the drug trade, and all the rest. And so that's the ludicrous argument. But states don't want to have threats against their power to print money. And so naturally, they're going to stand up to Bitcoin, as they've done in the U.S. They've made lots of threats. China has done the same thing. And other countries have also issued reports and requirements and so on and so forth to suppress Bitcoin. And this giant hack job on Mt. Gox, you know, you basically got to anticipate that there were holes in all the protocols of both Bitcoin and Mt. Gox itself, and that inevitably there would be a bank robbery. And so this was just one giant $500 million bank robbery that was accomplished. And we don't know whether or not they're going to be able to track down the perpetrators at this point in time. And of course, it's undermined confidence in Bitcoin, but I don't think it's going to stop Bitcoin. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure if they'll ever be able to completely stop Bitcoin and the 36 other cryptocurrencies that are vending to get into that market in a big way, especially given the fact that we're in a world currency war. Yeah. And Japan and Europe and China and the U.S. China just launched a big inflation campaign last year. Japan just launched a big anti-deflation inflation campaign. So, you know, and people are trying to get their money out of China, and people are trying to get their money out of Russia and Turkey and Brazil. And so Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies are just one way that people are trying to get out. And so
do you think it's a viable alternative to perhaps like a gold standard?
Not anytime soon. I think it's a viable alternative for somebody in China who's trying to get their money out of China. You know, they're going to do it by buying gold. They're going to buy Bitcoin. They're going to go to Macau to the casinos and buy, you know, $10 million worth of chips and then cash them out in Canadian dollars, putting them into a Canadian denominated bank account in Hong Kong, and they're going to do a lot of things. Mm-hmm. So all of this uncertainty is great for Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, and it's the uncertainty associated with fiat money that is helping to drive the demand as well as the instability of the value of Bitcoin. But if I had my way, I mean, my preference is multiple currencies, which would include gold and silver, possibly other commodity monies, and as well as cryptocurrencies and even other forms of money that may emerge. I think that money should be a product of the market, that it should represent property, and it should not be the prerogative of the state. And I think that once we get to a position like that, then we won't have problems of inflation in the business cycle, and we'll have a much more sustained prosperity because we don't have that instability. We'll have a much more equitable distribution of income because we won't have the inflation tax. And also, you know, commodity monies, well, let me put it this way, fiat monies, paper monies, allow the state to spend more resources than they can take in taxes, and therefore it's one of the greatest checks on the growth of government, and in particular, government's ability to wage war. So reform of money, you know, that's what the primary thing that the Mises Institute is about. You can find us on Mises.org, and it's all there for free. But money has always been our primary interest.
Oh, absolutely.
And for the Mises Institute, it's not about money. It's about the money. And we want good money, and private production of money is what would ensure a sound monetary system.
See, that's interesting you say that, because for me, I would see until we can get government to give up the ability to have the standard currency, the de facto currency, if you will. My big concern with Bitcoin, and I think you'll see it all the time, is that because it isn't the standard, it is an investment. I think the Winklevoss twins that, you know, were the people who Mark Zuckerberg got in a lawsuit with over Facebook. They're venture capitalists now and are backing everything in Bitcoin and Bitcoin related. And it's because people see it, since it has a hard limit, as a hedge against inflation and the money printing of government. And what I really want is that us to revert back to something with a truly hard limit, or something like gold, where you're not going to start mining it until the price you can sell it for is more than what it costs to actually dig it. And so if you were to be able to create like a Mises coin, let's say, what exactly would it look like? Would there be a hard limit on it? Would it be a cryptocurrency? Would it be a paper currency? And how would it be administered?
Well, my preferred means would be to have commercial companies and nonprofit companies issue silver coins in metric units, so the standard unit would be, say, a 25-gram coin with a company logo on it, and then we'd be competing against other coins. And, of course, just because you have, you know, silver coins doesn't mean that you don't have checking accounts, debit cards, electronic transfers, all that. You can still have all of that as long as the base money is silver, and that it's, you know, because of the variability in the price of silver versus gold and other precious metals, you would probably want to have, you know, companies producing gold, silver, and copper coins, and people able to deposit their money into accounts in different commodity monies. And I think that ultimately, you know, that's what emerged on the marketplace. What we've done since then is made it more accessible through checking accounts and debit cards and credit cards and so on. But fundamentally, I think we get back to a system that has some honest basis to it in private property. I think that at that point, we can turn the market loose, and that problems of money and macroeconomics would largely disappear, and it would force government to stay within its budget and within its means, and then the political process would really mean something in terms of controlling government.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. What about you, Joe?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, guys, it looks like we're coming against the end of the program here. So real quick, usually what we do, Dr. Thornton, at the end of the program is we give everyone an opportunity to plug anything that they've got currently going on, any projects that they're excited about, that kind of thing. Is there anything that you would like to tell us about?
Well, Joe, I've been plugging away all night.
I've noticed. I heard Mises.org, I heard Basquiat Reader. Yeah, there were several, but I didn't know if there was any one in particular.
Plus the free giveaways.
Yes.
But one thing that I really do want to plug is the Austrian Economic Research Conference. It's coming up at the Institute, March 20th through the 22nd. Some of the speakers are going to include Judge Anthony Napolitano, who's given a primary lecture, and Mr. James Grant of the Interest Rate Observer, who is probably one of the most prominent people on Wall Street, and probably the only prominent Austrian other than perhaps Peter Schiff. But James Grant is actually recognized across the board on Wall Street, and he's the only one defending the Austrian point of view in places like the Wall Street Journal. He's going to be there. We've got a lot of other very important lectures, and we're celebrating some historic things in the Austrian school. And, of course, you can come to the Austrian Economic Research Conference, and a lot of regular people do. But just like most of what we do, it's going to be broadcast live from the Institute, and then it'll be available on Mises TV on the YouTube channel. And all of the major lectures are going to be there. And so all the more tedious economic debates won't be, but at least all of the great important lectures will be. And so I encourage everybody to either attend the conference or watch us on Mises TV or come back and look at the podcast, because this, we've been doing this for years, and this is clearly the most important one we've ever had and the biggest headliners we've ever had. And at the same time, a much larger cadre of young Austrians are going to be present. And so that's one thing that you really need to put on your calendar, is the Austrian Economic Research Conference, March 20th through the 22nd.
Awesome. Is that at Mises.org? Can you find more information?
Oh, yeah. You can go to Mises.org and go to the events page. And you can also get on the Mises Academy page and log in there. And that gives you the ability to talk with other people who are watching it and even ask questions of some of the speakers.
Is there an opportunity, or do you think there will ever be, my wife and I, when we watch television, we often have our cell phones in our hands, so we're doing two things at once. And I often think we need to build a bridge for that, so you're doing something on your phone that interacts with what's going on the TV. And is there ever going to be an opportunity where we can read something like Man, Economy, and State? And have like a companion between the two technologies, so it's interactive. We can have a virtual simulation of Murray Rothbard guiding us through the study or something like that. I think that kind of technology would be really cool for teaching the kind of the works that you preserve at Mises.
Well, you know, we've been kind of an out-of-date traditional organization in the past. Mm-hmm. We've got a new president, Jeff Deist. And we're going to have a brand new webpage out this year and, you know, a full-size simulation of Murray Rothbard. I think it's going to happen, Joe.
Right on.
One more thing for, like, any listener that wanted a good book on sort of getting into the economics, but it's like a history thing. Is that okay?
Yeah, no. Go ahead.
And if anyone's out there listening, and now a lot of the Austrian work is easily understood. One book it was my introduction to first supply-side economics and then ultimately the Austrian school was called Econoclast by Brian Domitrovich from Sam Houston State University. It's like a historical account of Art Laffer and the supply-side revolution that happened under Reagan. And so even if you're totally against or you're not economically inclined at all, it's a great and exciting book on economics, which I know might be a contradiction for a lot of you. But check that out, and that will kind of baby feed, small steps lead you into the Austrian school. At least that's what it did for me.
Well, again, Mark, thank you so much for joining us. We would love to pick your brain again if you wouldn't mind joining us again sometime.
I'd love to, Joe.
Excellent. And as always with We Are Libertarians, we promise
to do better next time.
Have a great day, everybody.
Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell.